Okay, I got Kelda on the phone.
Hello.
We're doing some more of, is this chapter two? Jeez, I think there's only like five chapters in this whole book.
What is this? Yeah,
we're like halfway through the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we're only on chapter two. Alternative ways to keep livestock. So this is Sepp Holzer's permaculture. And I think we have to finish doing all the review of all of the book before Sepp gets here. Ooh, I just flipped through the pages and saw the bone sauce page. We need to get a couple of kettles together.
Mm-hmm.
So that way he can make bone sauce, and I'll try to get video of it.
Right. And, yeah, I mean, I talked about an earlier podcast of looking myself, but there's some work traders that are coming who might be in the area sooner, and so that might be a fun work trade task is to go to thrift stores and find two cast iron pots that match up in size.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, that might be on the horizon.
So, all right, so the bone sauce is coming in much
right,
later.
We're not there yet.
We're not there yet, but we did come across this. The section we just read, the bit that we just read, did have like one of the most important things. We're going to get to that in a minute, but starts off with alternative ways to keep livestock. Livestock play a large role in a permaculture system. They do not just provide high quality produce, which struck me as a little weird.
Yeah, it's a translation thing.
Like vegetables. Mm-hmm. They are also industrious and pleasant workers. Poultry, pigs, horses, cattle, sheep, goats, and many other animals can be used in a permaculture system. So, I'm thinking about, we're going to get down to pigs here in a moment, but did you hear my podcast where I talked about, it was at your event in Tacoma, where somebody asked about what do you do about blackberries?
Yeah, the pig question. Do the pigs work?
Yeah. Well, it was a blackberries question.
Right.
It was a pig answer.
Right. And, okay. Yeah.
Oh yeah, but then there was that. But now the thing is that I said the voice was like, and it's like, what was my voice? Was my attempt at relating how the guy asked the follow up question? Was that accurate?
So,
the funny part of it. Okay, so I'll
exaggerated a little bit.
A little bit? I don't think I did. I mean, it was like, you got to be kidding. Does that guy really talk that way? So, I was trying so hard to not laugh. But, of course, you can't help but laugh when you hear the answer. So, all right, I'll just retell the story just real quick.
Okay.
So somebody says, what do you do about blackberries? Sepp Holzer says, put a strand of electric around it and put pigs in there. And so some guy in the back asked something like, I'm a vegetarian and I'm not going to keep pigs. So what do I do about blackberries?
Mm-hmm.
So was that spot on? I'm trying really hard to not take it too far because I think it was actually worse than that. Like, yeah, I'm a vegetarian. So that would be exaggerating.
Well, to be perfectly honest, like I actually listened to very little of Sepp's talk, and you know, that I was there and I organized the event. Sometimes organizers know this, like your head is in a totally different place. Like I'm kind of like, okay, who's on cleanup crew? How much money did we make or not make? Like I had to listen to your videos afterwards to really get Sepp's talk.
Oh, right, because I've got three videos up.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So, and those, the hardest work from those videos was getting the official approval from Sepp to put them up on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because he said, you take the videos you want, but before they go on YouTube, I have to see them to make sure that they're okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then we had like, there was this other woman who was in the middle getting involved in that, who just like made it last forever, and she was a pain in the butt. And then later I put the videos up, and then apparently she told somebody that I put them up without permission. And so all these people were giving me the stink eye. And it's like, put it up without permission? I went through, I jumped through I don't know how many hoops to be able to get the permission to put them up.
Yeah.
So anyway, all right. So, but to finish the story,
yes.
Just for those who haven't heard it, then of course they said the guy says, "Okay, I'm a vegetarian. What do I do to control black bears?" And Sepp said, "Then you must do the pig's work." Next question. So that was one of my favorite things in the world.
I know,
that was a Kodak moment.
Because of you, it's Tacoma's claim to fame with Sepp Holter. Like, he said it in Tacoma. Yeah.
All right. So, on to the next.
And okay. So because of that, it's great to get this whole section on pigs. I just feel like he hasn't covered this before in any of his books, to really go into which kind of breeds and how he uses them, how he rotates them. Although I'd still like to see some specifics, like how long do they stay in paddocks and things like that. How big are the paddocks? This whole section is really cool.
Well, he covered paddock size, but he did not cover how often he moved them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, how often you're going to move them is going to depend greatly on the time of year.
Mm-hmm.
And the size of the pigs. He mentioned how many pigs, but, you know, it varies so much. But I want to get to that in a minute. You're right about the breeds. I mean, when I met him, one of the things he asked me, like, right out of the gate is, you know, he wanted to hear about what I've done and whatnot. And I mentioned that I was raising hogs, and he wanted to know, what breed?
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, Duroc. And then he's like, yeah, that's a good breed. And then here they are. Duroc's are listed in here,
mm-hmm.
As well as some breeds I've never heard of before. What interesting breeds! One of them is this. The last breed is one that's in his videos. But all right, I want to read a little bit from the very beginning of the pigs section. Pigs in a permaculture system. Pigs are an inseparable part of Holzer permaculture. The animals actually work for me by loosening the soil and tilling my terraces. For me, there is no more versatile or more helpful an animal, and I only need to give them the right opportunity. If I were to close them away in a pen, however, I would have to work for my pigs instead. That's funny.
Mm-hmm.
Like all domesticated animals, pigs have lost many of their old characteristics over years of selective breeding. These high-performance breeds are no longer suited to being kept under natural conditions. They would trip over their own feet on rough terrain, and they would scarcely survive in winter. In addition, they no longer have the natural instincts that they need to be good workers. For this reason, I only keep old pig breeds on my farm. Then he goes into four different pig breeds, and he goes into a lot of detail about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that first one's really cool. It's really hairy. They look like pig sheep.
Yeah, they do, don't they? Well, they look like they've been crossed. They're crossed between pigs and sheep and German shepherds.
Uh-huh.
Because they got like a German shepherd color, but they're pigs.
Uh-huh.
And they're extra woolly like sheep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's see. That's called the Mangalitsa. Mangalitsa. That's the first breed that he goes in. He writes the most about them, it looks like. Then Swabian Hall swine. Then Duroc. And then the Turipole.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like that's the breed that he talks about in his videos, or that he's got in his videos.
That scene with, like, it starts in the snow and the music, and then he's walking through the snow with the pigs. Yeah, that's the breed.
Yeah. So, and then it's got a picture. So it does seem to me that, like, in the videos as well as in the pictures that I've seen, he's not too terribly chummy with the pigs, which I think is generally a good policy because, you know, it's nice to keep kind of domesticate them and get them to be friendly and be able to pet them, you know, to get that level of friendly going on. That's a good thing. But at the same time, I always kind of, like, when I'm in with pigs, I'm always kind of like being cautious.
Oh,
because it's like, I'm a giant guy, but this animal weighs twice as much as I do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've housed that for farmers and, like, been on pig feeding duty and just been scared to death of going in that pen. It's like, there's
and
huge.
I think that's a a healthy fear. I mean, they're omnivores, which means I am food. So if we were to somehow mysteriously die, that they would feast for a few days. So it's just seems like it's a good policy to be cautious. And the videos, it always seems like Sepp's always, you can kind of see it in him. He's being really cautious. It's not like he's getting that chummy with the pigs. So there's a certain level of chumminess that's good, and at the same time, a little reservation. All right, so the next block I've got marked off here is, when building paddocks, I take note of how the pigs can help me best. Orchards and seedling nurseries make ideal places for them to work. In contrast to goat and sheep, they do not damage the fruit trees. There are often large amounts of windfall fruit in orchards, which can lead to the spread of fungus and mold. If pigs are put there in these areas to pasture at the right time, this danger can be averted to a great extent. As previously mentioned, properly directed, pigs can be a great help when regulating rapidly growing wild plants. So, if you're regulating rapidly growing wild plants, I think that's a euphemism for weeds.
Yeah, that could work.
Yeah, because we avoid using the word weeds, which I think is one of the funnest parts of permaculture. An agricultural research project in Germany has investigated the effect of large numbers of pigs, Duroc and Mangalitsa breeds, among others, on the plant kingdom when they were allowed to roam freely. The vegetation charting showed that the plant diversity in the areas grazed by the pigs doubled. The reason suggested is that plants growing in very overgrown areas that would otherwise not have the opportunity to develop suddenly had the chance to germinate and grow when the turf was broken.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the little tiny bits that I've just read, which is only just, I mean, a fragment, just a tiny fraction of all that's been written for this section. I just feel it's so profound and enormous. I mean, so many people are sure that, you know, that pigs would wipe everything out. And it's true. If you leave pigs in an area, if you put out a 20-foot by 20-foot area and then you put three pigs in there for 4 days – it'll be totally plowed, and nothing will probably grow there for months. It'll be utterly destroyed, and devastated. But I think that's going to be true no matter what animals you crowd animals in tightly enough, mm-hmm. and leave them there long enough, any patch of land is going to be utterly destroyed. The key is you put them in there for a while. To you know, work the land, and then before they've consumed 30% of it, you move them onto the next chunk of land.
Well, what I got from reading this part is, gosh, he's got so much property, you know, because true, they do increase the diversity, but while they're plowing things up, you can't, of course, be harvesting or expecting to harvest from that for, I'd say, maybe a month after, even if you're just doing radish greens or something. So, yeah, just to have the amount of land where you can keep them at a healthy carrying capacity where they can do their pigness is something that I think a lot of people who have pigs don't really have. So, I mean, maybe if you thought about neighborhood scale, how to keep pigs moving around that often and to have that touch that's just the right sweet spot of just enough but not too much. But, yeah, part of the problem is just not having enough land to do it.
True. And then, of course, you know, he's got like 110 acres.
Mm-hmm.
But 110 acres using this technique can support like 100 pigs. You know, but if you're talking about like you're in town and you've got an acre and a half.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it's kind of like an acre and a half is enough.
I mean, does he ever say how many pigs and cattle he keeps at the same time? Because
I haven't read anything yet.
Because that's another thing about the paddock system is, does he keep them in the same paddocks? Like he must have all these different kinds of fencing around the area for all of them. How does he move all the different species through at the same time? And yeah, maybe it's not 100 pigs. Maybe it's just, you know, 20 at a time or something, which seems more achievable as far as being able to observe what they're doing and move them on to the next one. And then he's got these kind of earth lodge shelters, which I wonder if he actually even just is like, all right, everybody out, we're going to the next paddock. You're going to be in a different shelter now. So
You've never raised pigs, have you?
Right. Well, I would think 100 pigs might be a lot even for his 110 acres. No.
Well, so here's what I did is that I had a boar and four sows, which is like just about the right number to keep everybody pretty comfortable. And then, so you put the boar in with the four sows, and then 3 months, 3 weeks, 3 days later, that's the gestation period, you generally have piglets. And so then if each sow has 10 piglets, now you've got this extra 40, so now you got 44. You got 44 animals. And I had 80 acres. And I think 80 acres was plenty for 44 and a variety of other animals. But then the thing is that, okay, now the piglets are going to get bigger, and you're going to sell off some wieners, and then you're going to sell off some hogs for pork.
Mm-hmm.
So for a while there, you got a lot more animals.
Right. Well, but he's also got so many ponds, and he's got, like, enough food to be feeding tourists all the time, and stuff that you didn't have on your 80 acres.
Well, I guess where I'm going is that, well, I had a bunch of other stuff going there too, but
right.
but I just terraced the land like just before I left the farm.
Mm.
I mean, at one point I had probably seen all three of his videos, which I had on VHS way back
yeah.
then.
Yeah.
And that was the only format they were available in for the longest time.
anyway.
And man. Yeah. Boy, was it a lot of work to get those too? They were like almost impossible to get. But so I got those, and I'd watch them like 20 times a piece, and I was in many ways emulating what he had done. But yeah, I was not up to Holzerian stuff yet on my 80 acres. But the key is that, okay, so one thing you mentioned was the paddock. Oh, like, hey, everybody move to the next paddock. And it kind of didn't go that way. What happens is is that when you go to the next paddock, you set up the next paddock, and then you just, you know, take out a piece of the fence between the two.
Yeah.
And then all the pigs already know, fresh candy! Yay! I mean, they start making this noise, like, oh, I can't wait, I got candy. Ooh, the candy's on the other side. Oh, come on, hurry up, open it, I can just taste it. And then when they start making that noise, all the other pigs hear somebody saying, hey, I hear somebody singing the candy song.
Mm-hmm.
And they all come. I want candy too. And then you open up the bit of the fence, and then vroom, they all run into the next paddock, and then you close the fence.
Right.
So it's like not hard. It's not like
you're having to go. Oh, I know. But I wonder if, like, if he's doing that many paddock rotations, if he's got it all set up from a central earth lodge that they stay in all the time, or if he actually moves them significantly enough to have them sleep in another place.
Oh, see, now I think that's a great question to ask him.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm going to guess at the answer, and I would guess that each time that they move to a new paddock, that they have a new shelter. Now, granted, and this is Savory's oldest work, and it's called a wagon wheel technique, and the idea is that you have
right.
a central shelter. And then you'll have like maybe eight paddocks in a, you know, surrounding the shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just like say, okay, now this paddock is open to the shelter. And then the
right.
next paddock is open to the shelter and so on. The problem with that is that then the animals are always at the same shelter. And so you can get all kinds of different parasites and funguses and stuff that build up at that shelter for that animal. It's like, that's not optimal. It's better to move like the pigs out, and then you can move the cattle in or something else in and keep changing up the species. So that way it's not, you know, accumulating funk for a particular species. I would guess that that's what he would do, but I don't know that for a fact. But I think that's a great question to ask him when he's here.
Yeah, let's ask. Yep.
Yeah, yeah, damn right. Okay. Let's see. Keeping pigs using a paddock system. So he does. All of his animals are managed with a paddock system. Let's see. I've got a little bit marked off here. Depending on soil conditions and vegetation, I keep between 3 and 12 pigs per hectare in a paddock. So a hectare would be 2.5 acres. And that, I seem to remember that was about the size that I often did. Was usually 1 to 3 acres, and then but I remember one time I let them be in one spot too long, and it was about 1.5 acres, but it was everybody and their babies. And one of the things I learned I know that there's a lot of places where they do this thing where it's like, okay, they just let all their sows be in one big bunch. And so I tried that. And I don't think I'd ever do that again. And it was, the results were just horrible. Because all the sows had their little ones all at the same time. And so all the little piglets would race from sow to sow to get milk.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, it was ridiculous. And so we had, boy, talk about runts. Suddenly, half of the piglets were becoming runts, and the other half were becoming giant. And it's kind of like, or maybe the other half were normal. But they just look giant because next to the runts. And so I just kind of think, you know what, in the future, not gonna allow the piglets to mix. That was the last batch of hogs I raised.
Well, and he talked about having them in family groups. So maybe he just means small families.
Well, I would say that for the, because usually you sell wiener pigs at 6 weeks, and so I would say up until the point, you know, of being wiener pigs, go ahead and keep them separate. One pig shelter per sow with her litter, and I think that would be the best way to fly, keeping them separate like that. At least I'm sure I don't want to mix them again. Or maybe somebody's got like some information on how to make that not happen. Like what did happen to me? I know I don't want to see that happen again. But I can't. My imagination hasn't come up with any ideas. All right. The next section I've marked off is, even in winter, they find enough food beneath the snow. The pigs like to dig up Jerusalem artichokes, which taste like sweet potato. When the pigs move from one paddock to the next, the churned up soil is sown with a mixture of different crops, turnips, potatoes, cabbages, peas, etc. In the next paddock, I then use pigs to do other things, such as reducing the number of stinging nettles between the fruit trees. This paddock will also be sown with a mixture of seeds after it has been grazed. So this kind of reminds me of some of the things that Helen Attow would say about her living mulches, about how the way to get the mulches to release their nitrogen and thus share with everything else would be to stress the plants. And it sounds like rather than going in there with a mower, hey, you can just put pigs in there. You can put really anything in there to help stress the plants. But Helen, of course, is big on her veganic path, mm-hmm. which would be there are no animals, no domesticated animals involved at all. Of course, she's not going to keep out the wild animals. With Jerusalem artichokes, the pig's digging behavior is particularly helpful because the soil is not only loosened, it also spreads the tubers. So yeah. I think that's kind of awesome. You by having pigs in there, you actually end up with more Jerusalem artichokes.
Mm-hmm.
Then it goes into wild cattle and old domestic cattle breeds. Do you have anything else to add about pigs?
Nope, but with the cattle, it was interesting because he's like, okay, I'm going to talk about cattle now. And then the first four species aren't really what we think of as cattle. He talks about bison and yaks and water buffalo.
Right, and he also had some other things in there that I've never even heard of.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to find the part in the book where it's like, you know, oh, there it is. Bison, European bison, American bison, yaks, water buffalo,
mm-hmm.
and then the Scottish Highland cattle, Hungarian, so I raised Scottish Highland cattle for a while, Hungarian steppe cattle, and Dahomey miniature cattle, so cattle. Oh, okay. I thought that there were some critters in there that it's like, man, what is that? But
there's another spot. I'm trying to think of where that is, but I remember seeing that too.
Yeah, as I was reading, I was like, what the hell is that? But I do remember that part of what he did like 30 years ago or something like that is he kind of used the property as kind of like a type of zoo.
Uh-huh.
And so he's pretty familiar with interesting species of critter. And he's pretty savvy in that space. But I don't know, a lot of the stuff that he does, it kind of, you know, pushes my knowledge of species of critter. But if nothing else, I would think that visiting Sepulcher's Farm at any time would be a little bit like visiting a zoo.
Yeah. Well, and I just don't think of American bison as something that's like in the Alps. And here we've got pictures, you know, of his American bison next to his Highland cow in a paddock together.
Right.
And I was kind of stunned. I was like, they're definitely prairie creatures. I don't even picture them, you know, of course, they were really in Western Washington, though. We do have a few places around that keep them now, but it's kind of, that's the permaculture thing is like, will this work? Will this animal be, you know, happier here than other places? Could it, you know, and is it, especially for bison in the United States, it's like there's so much more, such a better fit for the land in so many situations that it's just funny that Seth is experimenting around with them, but I can't point to any other permaculture folks I know, not in the plains, who are thinking about bison. So, and even in the plains.
Well, there's bison right out my window. There they are.
Yeah, you're in Montana, yeah.
I'm in Montana, but it's like, you know, we've got this flat patch, and then, but no, the bison range, which is, I don't know, about half an hour from here, that's all hilly and mountainy and lumpy.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so, I don't know, bison in the mountain. I mean, the thing that we normally can imagine them being is in a herd of hundreds or thousands.
Right. And it's interesting because, like, I can't even think of what cattle would be naturally, probably something like that. But we're just so much more used to cattle being on farms that I just had this mental block of, like, but bison should be in these big herds in the plains. Like, what, you know, what are they doing up in the forest?
No, what strikes me is weird about the picture is seeing one.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that, but maybe that's, we do the same thing with cattle, or we do the same thing with pigs, or, you know, there's ways that they just are naturally, and we just happen to know how bison are naturally because of the sad story about it. So, but that might be a mental block for us actually figuring out how to make them work with what's going on now in a way that everybody's happy. Might be possible.
Right, definitely a herd animal. Part of the reason why we'll see herd animals not like being off by themselves is because the lack of predators. It's because they got into the big bunches because of the predators. They were safer that way.
Right.
Less likely to be picked off.
Right, the holistic management thing. And here, just so, you know, so listeners know, the bison is not completely alone. It's standing next to a cow.
Yeah, a Scottish Highland cow, but which looks puny and tiny compared to the bison.
Ridiculous just, tiny, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, oh, bison are a lot bigger, aren't they? So they are a huge critter. All right, so I'm trying really hard to not mark up too much of this for reading because, you know, I don't want to hear about copyright problems. But all right. So here's the next part I have marked off for under cattle. Some of the parts from feed. He talks about feed. He says, I limit additional feeding to during the winter because I use a paddock system. Like the pigs, the wild cattle also have lush forage fields at their disposal, in which they can find their winter food in the form of turnips, fodder kale, Jerusalem artichokes, and many other plants. They also get hay, grain, and apple and pear pomace, which is left over from making juice and cider on the farm. So, my impression is that for the cattle, they end up bringing in saving some feed for them. I was a little surprised to see grain on the list here, but I do think that when I raised cattle, which was very much a grass-fed operation, I do know that I would take some grain out to them once in a while, mostly because if I ever got to the point where they got out of the fence, or if I wanted to get their attention for one reason or another, or get them to come to me mm-hmm. from like a big paddock or something like that, then I wanted to attract them with candy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always would think of the grain as being their ice cream, and that they would come a running. So yeah, once in a while, give them a little bit of that, and then say something. So cows is the start of this. I'm sure. For each different animal, you got to have a different sound, so that way they'll come running at the sound. I think so. Sorry, that's what I did for cows. Cows, and then they would come. Ooh, did you say candy? I think I heard you say candy. Like, you got some candy for me. Mm-hmm. And then they'd come, mm-hmm. you know. So, all right. next little bit. Well, don't you do that?
I would moo. I think I would moo instead. Moo. Like, I just cows just seems like not their language. Whatever.
Yeah, you think you can speak cow.
I think I can speak cow better than cow, yeah. Yep.
Well, I'm not comfortable enough with my masculinity to go out and moo. You know. That's what it is. I need to grow to be able to moo to yeah. cows as an adult. All right, moving along. By observing throughout the year, I have been able to establish that animals which have a lush flora and a variety of poisonous mushrooms available to them stay healthy. Mm-hmm. They also no longer need to be wormed. The district vet from Murau, Dr. Fritz Rosian, has been examining our livestock and issuing the necessary health certificates for the Tamsweg District Council for decades. Dr. Rosian was very enthusiastic about this system. I have had the same success with other livestock. You only have to make sure that these plants are present in large enough numbers and are richly diverse. The animals can use their instincts to decide for themselves when and which plants they require. Obviously, they should not be put in a position where they have to eat these plants out of hunger because they cannot find anything else. For this reason, you should, under no circumstances, mix herbs or poisonous plants into the feed yourself. Only the animals know what they need.
And you started reading the part with mushrooms, but for listeners, like, there's a few sentences prior talking about there's different poisonous plants that should be grown in the landscape for the animals to choose from. So it made sense later on, but you went from mushrooms to plants without the introduction.
True.
Sentence. So,
true.
Yeah.
He mentions lupins, monkshood, male fern, buttercups, and even poisonous mushrooms. So,
cool.
And we've got a whole thread about this. This is something that comes from his presentations a few years ago. It is something that's not a common thing. In fact, whenever I try to talk to people about the idea of how, you know, like when we talk about the Wheaton Eco Scale and how people that are further ahead of you might seem crazy,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard to tell who's crazy and who's brilliant. You know, they all sound crazy. This is a place that I usually go to is to talk about this. So, for example, you know, it sounds crazy, but then, you know, you say, okay, we're going to put our animals in this paddock, and we're going to make sure that before we put them in there, we're going to make sure there's lots of poisonous plants in there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then so a lot of people are like, what? That's crazy. Those animals will die.
Well, I think for a lot of people, the first thing is just making sure that there's a lot of edible plants. I mean, you don't want to – a lot of people just put animals out in the paddock system that, you know, just has a few plants but not tons of edible plants. And so down the scale for a reason, because you wouldn't want someone saying, okay, I've just got this, you know, few kinds of grass, and then I'm going to put poisonous plants. It's like, well, think about the edges first and getting all sorts of Jerusalem artichokes or – turnips, other things growing first, and then think about your poisons later. The food is more important.
Well, I think that the poisonous plants are going to show up on their own,
right?
For one,
true.
And then plus the other thing is like rather than being conventional ag and saying, okay, I'm going to allow two species of plant in here, and I'm going to poison everything else, or I'm going to allow only grasses in here because this is pasture, right? So I'm going to allow only grasses. I'm going to poison everything else. Get out my herbicides and stuff. So as a permaculture folk, we don't do that. And I think that what happens is that when you have your pasture and you have lots of shrubs and trees also, then in time, your diversity accumulates, especially if you're doing paddock shift systems. So then the pastures become more and more diverse. And you might start off buying land, and it's like maybe nobody's touched it for 20 years. And then you show up, and there's maybe 20 species growing on that land. And then after working it a la permaculture for a while, you might have 100, 150 species. The foods tend to dominate, and then the poisonous plants tend to take a back seat.
Right.
And
show up, nevertheless.
Yeah. Yeah. So, the key is that it's true that you're going to make sure that your pasture has lots of poisonous plants for your animal, for your grazing animals, for all your animals. And there's other schools of thought where people will go and learn how to recognize poisonous plants and eliminate them,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, animals have died from eating that. Well, of course they died from eating that when there's nothing else to eat.
Right. And you can, I don't know if I've shared this story before, but I was traveling to one of the rural places around here and, you know, saw this horse standing in this field of tansy, and it was just so sad because of course they're gonna take a munch at it every so often. That horse has probably been in that field for 10 years eating all the grasses way back and then eating it again and finally killed, you know, the good stuff to eat, and that leaves all the other poisonous plants just to proliferate. So that's not
right.
That's not the land's problem, that's a management design problem.
Right. I mean, I've seen that many, many times too. And I know that when I was up on Mount Spokane on our little road, you know, whenever you drive into town, it's like, I remember this one pasture where this gal was this big horse fan. And so she had like six horses on this 20 acre pasture, and she just left them all on the same 20 acres all the time. And it was like, and she ended up with six horses, maybe it was four horses sometimes, but typically six horses, with six horses throughout the spring, summer, and fall. That should be plenty of food when you do a paddock shift system, but she didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is that all of everything was nibbled down to the ground in that whole pasture, and she had to feed them hay.
Yeah, that's a good example.
You know,
the same amount of land, just managed differently, and you wouldn't have to be feeding them hay.
Right. And then plus, you know, it does seem like they're so famished for greenery that that they would eat toxic plants just to have greenery, not because that they're currently needing it. So it's like, yeah, this is a terrible way to raise these animals.
Go ahead, you finish first.
Oh, I was just going to say, I remember another thing was that there was this couple on the road who they were just kind of toxic. They called like every government office there was to report everybody on the road for anything that they could see from the road that they even, you know, imagined that there could be something going on. But those same people, nobody ever called on them because nobody retaliated, even though everybody knew who it was. Those same people, like they had some horses where like the hooves had grown so long because they're standing around on their own shit all day because their packs are tight. Their hooves had grown so long that they were like curved up. And it's like, you know, how does a horse – so they aren't standing on their hooves. They're kind of standing on the side of their hooves, which have grown crazy weird because they can't go and walk somewhere where it wears down their hooves even in a natural way. They're standing on their own shit. It's all soft. Anyway.
Yeah.
Other wrong ways of doing this. All right, so what was your thing?
Oh, well, it was the side note. Like, do you ever wonder if these people that you occasionally talk about on your podcast might ever listen to the podcast? All these neighbors or people you meet at parties or, you know, it's just after listening to so many of them, it's just like, wow, is he concerned? Maybe one of them will turn it on and the topic will be about them.
Wow, that's, you know, so I you'll notice that I didn't mention any names.
Right, of course.
And I do think that some of these people would somehow come to the conclusion that I'm not talking about them, even if I am.
Okay.
Because that's human nature. But yeah, I didn't mention any names, and it did seem to me like a lot of people they raised their animals and they were sure that the way that they were raising their animals was the best way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So standing on their own shit with their hoof all grown out and curved weird, the best. And it's like so are they gonna listen to a podcast? Well, no, because they already know the best.
Well, I think what happens too is that after a permaculture training, it's like we get so used to being like, oh, that's how food is grown or how our animals are grown. This is pre-permaculture, and then afterwards, your eyes are kind of open to like, why are those animals standing around so much of their poop? Like, why are these vegetables grown in such a way that, you know, they need to be watered? Like, you see, you start to see all the stuff that is, I guess you could say it's on that eco scale, even further crazy, or it's just even more sustainable. And it's just different kinds of people approach a different way with either saying like, oh, you know, this and this could happen, so you don't have to water your vegetables or so you don't have to feed your animals. Or there's also the other side of permaculture folks who come in and be like, this is, you know, this is so wrong and so nasty that you're evil for even trying to raise horses, you know, something like that. So there's
well, which is the people who called on the other people who called the government and reported
mm-hmm.
all these other people. And of course, most government offices are complaint driven.
Right.
And so the thing is, so those people were sure that what they were doing was the best. And then they would drive by down the road and see other people doing something different.
Mm-hmm.
And since it's different, it is therefore not the best by their own judgment. And so then they would report them. They would call and report. And this is why I think that for my own designs, I kind of think a lot about like, okay, important criteria are to have tall berms along the perimeter, to have thick brush in a hedge around the perimeter, because it's like, man, it is amazing. If somebody can see what you're doing and they drive by and they're just anybody, it's like, man, some people just have a lot of time on their hands and hate in their heart, and they just gotta they just gotta, you know, be nasty. And so this particular couple who lived on the hill, that was how they were wired. And it just seemed like the thing to do was, how can you make it so that what you're doing cannot be seen? And then that way you could probably have a more peaceful life. I know that that particular couple, they were the only couple. They were the only house in where I lived on Mount Spokane that could see onto my property. And I got reported for all kinds of stuff. Although the awesome thing was is that when I got reported, I would end up on the phone with these government people, you know, and then they would say, okay, technically I got to shut you down, but you know, I would tell them what I'm doing, and they're like, that's the coolest thing I've ever heard of. How's it working? You know, it's like, right. You know, so then I'd have these awesome conversations with these guys that are pretty knowledgeable in the space, and they're like, you know, all excited about it, and so then, you know, I think what they usually did is they ended up losing the paperwork, but you know, you're not always going to be that lucky, because you know, yeah. Well, anyway, yeah. It's a yeah.
Anyway.
All right. So that's all I've got for this section. And the next one we're gonna do poultry.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else?
Well, I just want to say that there's all these really dear pictures. Like we were talking about bad animal systems, and just like, you know, there's pictures of all these happy animals. Pigs wallowing in the mud and cows hanging out with trees and flowers and stuff and Step talking to them. It's really dear, I guess, after reading this section. I was just like, wow, this is such a happy, beautiful system. So thank you for the photographs, because we didn't get that in the last book so much.
I think that one of the great ones is like, okay, you got your Scottish Highland cattle, and they're obviously in a thick forest.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is one thing that not a lot of people know about Scottish Highland cattle. They're more browsers than grazers. Most cattle are grazers. And so, of course, you know, we talk about food forests.
Right.
And, that reminds me. Well, we talk about food forests, and, of course, Scottish Highland cattle are an awesome match for a food forest. Because they're browsers. They, mm-hmm. they nibble on brush and trees.
Mm-hmm. Great.
More than they graze on grasses and forbs, which is what most cattle do. But I got a call yesterday from Jocelyn, and she just came back from like a Transition Woodinville event or something like that, and so she was telling me that it was a little frustrating for her because she mentioned food forests. And some guy that was there, like, came unglued and got kind of hysterical because you cannot feed people from a food forest.
Oh, I wonder, you know what's going on is, she actually went to the event I was hoping that I might be able to go to too, but too much stuff. But so there's been this design team in the permaculture course that's been working to get the Beacon Food Forest going in Seattle, and so it's all over the news lately. Have you seen any of the, it's like Seattle Times, King 5,
I heard
NPR.
It was on CNN.
Yeah, it's big. It's big time. And so it's this group, Gwen and Jackie, and basically it was a design team project, and Jenny Pell and Marisha and I were the teachers, and so that's been all over. But it's been interesting. I've been reading through the comments and all these different news sources, and some people are just hating on it. And it's like, I went, you know, like, really? Hating on a food forest? I mean, it's just, the area right now is just this grassy lawn that has to be mowed, maintained by, I think, Seattle Public Utilities. So, anything is an improvement, really, and especially food that is open to the public for anybody to come and eat. And so some of the comments are like, well, that, you know, it's everything across the board from like, well, that won't actually feed people enough food, or this is, you know, this is competition with the convenience store down the road, and they're going to be really upset. it's not going to, like, if, I mean, it'll be produce, and it'll be a great example of, like, how you can grow produce throughout the year in the Seattle climate, which it'll be amazing. I mean, obviously, it's not going to be enough to feed all of the neighborhood, but, like, you know, calorie-wise, like that pot, or that video you did with Toby and Norris, but it'll be nutrient-wise, you know, maybe blueberries for some kids who didn't really have access to blueberries, fresh blueberries before or something like that. So anyway, I think what Jocelyn maybe encountered is one of the people who's been hating on this food forest thing, which is really, really strange.
You're right. I mean, it did seem like it had something to do with that.
Uh-huh.
And so Jocelyn attempted to, you know, offer information, and the guy was just apparently really hostile. But he's like all about green and eco.
Huh.
And so it's just kind of like another example of like, wow, you know, the biggest problem that we have in the world of permaculture is permaculture people.
Well, and I wonder if it's, I mean, maybe it's like an affront to someone who feels so knowledgeable that they would open up the Seattle Times and read about something that they hadn't learned about before, you know? And so it just could be like, you know, that they're not, they might not feel like they're in the know, and here, like, you know, the news media caught it before they did, even though permaculture is, I mean, pretty widespread in Seattle within the, you know, within the more progressive movement. People know what the word is, to, you know, and so I feel sorry for that guy.
Yeah, it just kind of seems to me like, wow. I mean, it's just another example of massive ignorance. But apparently this guy, and so he went on to talk about how he has an acre and a half, and him and his wife get something like, it sounds like they get a good 60-65% of the food that they consume every year.
Oh, yeah.
From their land.
Uh-huh.
But of course, all of his stuff is very conventional gardening. And so then Jocelyn tried to ask him about, like, do you bring stuff onto your land, or do you grow your own fertilizer? And it sounded like even then his answers were not very clear. But it kind of comes back to this thing that we were just talking about a moment ago, about how people have this thing in their head about how the way that they are currently doing it is the best way.
Mm-hmm.
So if anybody else does anything else, it must therefore be not the best way.
Right.
And so they're going to rail against it.
Right. And maybe because he's been growing his own food, he's just picturing, well, you can't grow food in the shade. And then it would take walking through a food forest system to see that, yes, there is shade from the trees, but there's all these patches of sunlight where food is grown. And then, of course, the trees are producing food. So it might just be, he just might be one of those show me people, you know?
Right. Oh, absolutely. I mean, most of these people, that's exactly how they are. They're this way. They're utterly hostile and saying it can never, ever be done. Stop spreading these lies.
Mm-hmm.
And then you show it to them and prove it to them, which that in itself is a painful and difficult process. But, okay, so now they've seen it. Now they understand it. And then their position is that they never were against it, that this is what they were advocating all along.
Yeah.
And so,
right. And I think what's happening with this vegan food forest thing is people are coming out who, like, are hating on hippies who just want to grow food. Like, that's crazy. And then the people who know something about food are like, this is, it's way too not how food is grown. And so maybe that explains some of the complexity of why there'd even be comments against a food forest. Sorry, I interrupted
you.
Yeah,
it's a painful thing. But of course, this guy was apparently he's a hotshot with some of the eco groups in the Seattle area, and he's on the board of this and the board of that, and it's kind of like, wow. Ooh. Mr. Hostility.
We'll have to ask who it, like, is after we turn off the podcast machine.
Well, Jocelyn didn't share with me any names. I don't know. I don't know who it is. But I do think that this is really typical. I mean, you know, the kinds of hate mail that I get. I mean, like, I saw something last night. I followed a link or something like that, and then I found a site where people were talking about rocket mass heaters. And it's like, oh, wow, look at this huge forum thread about rocket mass heaters. They're learning about it. They're talking about it. There's all this enthusiasm. There's some people saying, I've built one.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this guy that said, I have a degree in, you know, fire stuff. I can't remember what he said, but his, it's like, you know, you have a 75% efficient wood stove, and it's like, that's, so he was like being crazy hostile. And my thinking was like, dude, if you don't want to try a rocket mass heater, just don't do it. Okay.
Right.
Just
you don't have
down.
To spend your time on the floor and blasting someone else. And if I, again, it might be that thing. It's like he wasn't taught it in school, so he's not in the know. And so then there's a sense of...
Oh, yeah. So 20 years ago when he was in school, they didn't talk about this existing or whatever.
Right.
Therefore, it must not exist, or therefore it must be stupid, or therefore it must be bad.
And I think there's a bit of reluctance, which is healthy. I mean, gosh, just because, you know... You know, it came out on the permaculture forum doesn't mean it's the way everything should be done, but to approach
skepticism
it with...
Skepticism is good. Critical thinking is so important, but, you know, bashing the crap out of something you don't know about?
Yeah.
And so it's, I don't know, I've seen this so many times now where it's like people are, there's just so much hysteria. So this guy is, I mean, if nothing else... Africa. I mean, I just finished reading the Poison Wood Bible,
mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like people there don't garden really. They it's all food forest. That's how you eat.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, agriculture is stupid. And so that's a big part of the Poison Wood Bible is the idea of all these white folks coming down and it's like, let's do agriculture. It's like. Why? Why would you do that? And it just seems like, man, these white people are so nuts. Why do they keep trying to plant stuff in the ground? Look, the food's all over the place right here, mm-hmm. man. So, so this guy's saying, you know, you cannot feed people from a food forest. Now, I think if a definition of a food forest is a bunch of conifer trees, and that's your forest, and then you're going to say, now I'm going to eat food from it.
Right.
Well, yeah, that's really
and
not going to work out.
Okay, so like any news item, I was actually in a meeting last Wednesday where someone was talking about urban agriculture, and she was like, she didn't quite know what she was talking about, but she's like, and then there's this group that's going to build this forest, and we're going to go harvest from it. So that's a new kind of community garden. And she didn't say food forest in her whole, like, you know, she talked about it for 2 or 3 minutes. She didn't say food forest or edible, you know, tree, orchard, anything that would convey that it's fruit and nut trees. She just said forest and food, like it was going to be growing underneath the conifers. And so, you know, if you don't read the article, if you hear about it from someone else who said it like that, and you heard it read from someone else who said it like that, then yeah, that, you know, you're growing ferns and mushrooms in that situation.
Right.
But not,
that is
not a lot of chestnuts and apples and stuff like that, no.
Well, and so, right, if somebody hears that description,
yeah.
then they're going to be like, yeah, I don't think that's going to
work. Right, and that's the healthy reluctance of, like, these hippies, they're going to try to grow vegetables under the dug firs.
They're so stupid. The hippies are so fucking stupid. So, yeah, you're right. And it does, there's a lot of learning curve here, and we're making progress. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about the food forest project out there. I mean, the thing is of course there's lots of food forest projects going on, mm-hmm. in lots of different places.
Yeah.
But man, somehow the one over on Beacon Hill, somebody really knows their PR, you guys got awesome press.
Right.
Way to go!
Oh, I know, it's been amazing, and I think, I mean, there are other public food forests. This might be the biggest one with 7 acres. I mean, there's other ones around I could think of, but they're, you know, like not even a city block. And then, how big is the city block? But it's part of a big park. And then also that it was like this long process that involves the community. It's not like a nonprofit owns this piece of land and then they're doing it as a demonstration. It's more like they had to go through all of these rigorous channels to get permission from this person, then change this over to this and do this whole bidding process. And all of that seems kind of like a pain in the ass, right? But then because they have so many different partners, it's made it so much more newsworthy, I think.
Well, I do know that in the Seattle area, that there's on the northern side of Seattle, there's a park which has been like designated as a park, but they kind of haven't really done anything with it. And over the last 5 years, they're doing more with it to make it parkish. But apparently, like 15 or 20 years ago, some guy that lived like two blocks away from the park started planting a whole bunch of fruit trees and stuff in there.
Are you talking about the hedgerow?
It definitely wasn't a hedgerow that I saw.
Okay.
It was definitely a bunch of brambles, and maybe somebody at some point thought they were making a hedgerow, but I don't think so. It didn't look like that kind of thing. It wasn't planned that way. But it's like, I remember it's on like 103rd or 105th.
That's above Nathan Hale High School, and there's a bunch of chestnut trees planted in there, and there is a hedgerow, actually. And there's different permaculture folks who've lived in the neighborhood who've kind of like handed the baton to each other at different times, and it is
right.
It was kind of like a weird no man's land because it was like above the high school in this area that wasn't really thought of as a park so much, but more into the neighborhood. And there's a lot of cool stuff going on there. I've taken permaculture groups over there to check out what's growing, you know, because you'll have a chestnut tree coming up in between blackberries, stuff like that. And all these cool species mixed in. But there is a part of like, that's a groovy neighborhood where people have continued to be stewards. You know, it's one thing to be a steward,
right?
But this is something where everybody's just doing their little bit to keep it maintained and to plant more.
So I remember going out there. Arthur Lee Jacobson had like a little wild edibles walk.
Oh, that'd be fun out there.
And he did it out there, and then he said, you know, and so then he was telling the story about how, you know, many, many years ago, this guy did this, and then he died. But,
no,
and
he's still alive.
Well,
unless we have two
really
different parks on 105th.
So the key is that, and then, of course, the area was just, like, you know, unmanaged, and then the city is starting to come in, and they're kind of mow it, and it's kind of a little bit of a dog poop park, but not labeled as anything because, you know, it's kind of far enough away from their community center and their fancy pants parks, and it's on a hill, so it's kind of hard to put in a baseball diamond there.
Right, we're talking about the same park,
Yeah, and so then, so now the city's starting to like, you know, think, oh, we got to do something with this, you know? And so they're trying to, he said something about how he tried to talk to the people that were managing that chunk of land and trying to convince them to not cut down all these fruit trees that had been planted there. And they were kind of like, that's okay with me. That is less work. And so they're, anyways, but this is years ago. This had to be 5-6 years ago that Arthur Lee Jacobson was doing this. And I imagine it's got passed. I remember that there was an email list created and somebody was sending around an email saying, hey, let's all go over and try to, you know, do things to help encourage the fruit trees. You know, basically, it's a food forest. You can either leave it alone and it'll produce a certain amount of food, or you can go out there and kind of put a few hours into some pruning and whatnot, and it'll produce, you know, twice as much or four times as much, whatever. And so somebody was saying, hey, let's go do this. And I never went to go and do any of that. But it was kind of cool to know that people were like trying to, you know, and it would be great if there was a really awesome symbiotic relationship between this group of people that are like, you know, wanting to play in that space and the park management folks who might someday come through and cut them all down and chop them all off take them all.
I think there is some symbiosis now. Yeah, those groups definitely know each other and are talking to each other.
Awesome.
Yeah. But,
awesome.
But again, the Beacon one is just so much bigger and so much, you know, more organized according to something that, you know, a news reporter could say, like, oh, there's this group and you work with this group and the other. And whereas, like, that Hillside one has just kind of been like, well, someone did this and someone else did this and then we forgot about it for a while. And except for, you know, we
definitely
just
kind
eat from
it. Guerrilla gardening.
Pardon?
Definitely kind of guerrilla gardening.
Yeah, yeah.
The one that's up on that other hill there, they just went in and started planting stuff on the sly.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know if it's completely it's like, I don't want to give too many names and specifics, but I can tell you can do a podcast with the guy who created it if you want to. How about that?
Okay. So he's not dead. Oh, okay.
No,
all
he's
right.
Not dead. He just moved away.
The one on Beacon Hill, have they started planting anything there yet?
No, that's the thing. Is like, it just takes so long to go through all the different stuff that they've got. But, so I think summer, fall, they're going to break ground. But it's funny because to read all these news articles, and then there's this picture of this hillside that's like just the lawn. And then the design. They do shoot show pictures of the design, but not quite yet.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm glad that permaculture is getting that much press. So,
yeah, because all the articles mention permaculture, which is cool. And then they have to define it because, like, you know, you just have to. People know what you're talking about. So.
Oh, great. Because it's like, you ask 100 different permies, what does permaculture mean? And I think you're probably going to get at least 60 different answers.
Right. It's been pretty good. Yeah. If anybody's been following the story, there have been some, like, they said they were going to be growing pineapples. And so whenever I've been seeing a news article and then posting a comment, it's like, by the way, someone made up the pineapple thing. Pineapples are not going to be grown in Seattle. Sorry, everyone. I don't know what news reporter put that in. And then they start copying each other, you know? So the pineapple thing's getting around, but it's not true.
Right. Well, hey, at least a lot of people are probably going to Wikipedia or something to look up permaculture. Mm-hmm. So, getting an idea of what it's all about. Yay. Great. We'll have a food forest demonstration hopefully soon, and hopefully we won't get a bunch of people who don't know what the hell it is demanding that, you know, that it not be a food forest or something, you know, calling it a food forest but making it something twisted and messed up. Hopefully, I just hope it'll turn out cool.
Turn out cool, yeah. And it does have community garden plots that are kind of more, you know, as people think about it. So someone will walk in and kind of feel like they understand the first parts of it. So that helps them.
Yeah, lots of signs and stuff describing everything. Yeah, cool. All right. You want to do the sign-off thing?
Let's see. If you like this sort of thing, I got to come out to permies.com, where we talk about food forests, homesteading, sepulcher, and permaculture all the time.
Oh, that was awesome!